All right. Well, this is James Newberry, and I'm here with Mr. William Bill Adams on Tuesday, January 19th, 2021. And we're conducting this interview over Zoom, obviously. I appreciate you taking part. And Mr. Adams, do you agree to this interview?
I do.
Sorry about that. That's my email coming in. Let me close that out real quick. Don't want that interfering with us. Okay. So could you please state your full name?
My full name is William Gordon Adams, Sr., and preferred Bill is my nickname.
And what's your birth date?
My birth date is July 8th, 1947.
What were your parents' names?
My father's name was Morton A. Adams, and my mother's name was Elizabeth W. Adams.
What did they do for a living?
My father worked for Southern Railroad in Atlanta, Georgia. And so he commuted from Marietta via Greyhound bus to Atlanta every day. He worked as a porter, I would imagine, in an office setting where he did copying work, picked up the mail, things like that. My mother worked for Slater System, which was part of Lockheed, and she was a food preparation person that actually worked the food line and things like that. She also did domestic work in the area.
How long did she work at Lockheed? Do you know?
She worked there approximately, I'd say between 5 and 10 years.
And what was the time period that she was working there?
From what I can remember, it was probably mid-50s, 55 or so, up through maybe mid-60s or so.
How did she commute to work?
Mostly it was with co-workers, or she would commute by cab. Eastside cab service was right down the street from where we lived, and she would either commute by cab or with co-workers.
Did you have any siblings?
I had one brother. His name was Morton Adams Jr. He was affectionately known in the area as Juju, J-U-J-U. And so he was 13 years older than I was, though, so that was a big difference. He was drafted into the military during the Korean War. So we had a 4-year separation where I probably would see him maybe once in that 4-year time period.
Wow.
And he passed away in 2011.
So I know you grew up in Marietta. Can you describe the location where your parents' home was?
Well, our home was on East 4th Street, where 4th Street intersects with Fairground Street. We were about the third house on the right if you were coming from Fairground Street up East 4th Street. And so we weren't not that far from our school, Lemon Street, but I would walk to school daily. And that was a small community, one of the small communities there in Marietta.
Who were your neighbors?
Well, across the street was my aunt. Her name was Fanny Bray. I had cousins that lived a block or so down the street. Their name was my Uncle Henry and Aunt Ursuline Adams, and they had 4 children. And some of the other people in the area, my best friend, John Robinson, he lived a couple of houses down the street from me. The Wrights, and that was about it. There were other people in the community, but I'm trying to remember some of the names now.
That's a pretty good number you just named. Yeah. Well, you talked about walking to school. Can you tell me the route and what you passed on the way?
Well, it was a pretty familiar route that everybody in my neighborhood would take. We would go up 4th Street, and at the top, we call it the hill. And so at the top of the hill, we make a right turn down Shepherd Street. And then that was a church, Mount Sinai Baptist Church. So we would take a shortcut, we'd call it, behind that church and then down through a wooded area that ran adjacent to Lemon Street. And then we'd take that all the way down because it was kind of a hill. So you'd go down the hill, all the way down the hill, and that would kind of intersect with Lemon Street. And then we walked the rest of the way down the sidewalk to the school. So that way sometimes we would change up. Sometimes we'd go different ways, but that was the main route that I would take to school most days was up the hill, downhill to the school.
Were you with a group of kids or?
Normally it was my friend, John Robinson, my cousins, Rita Adams, Harold Adams, and then some other kids in the neighborhood. Some have passed on now, but it was mostly maybe five or six kids that would take that route to school, to school and back from school every day, which was a lot of fun because we would on the way to school, we'd play little games and just have fun with each other walking to school. There was also buses that would pick children up, but that was mainly for folks that lived in the county. Most of the folks that lived in the city limits, their parents either drove them to school or we'd have to walk.
Do you know if that bus system was the school system or was it a private bus system? The ones that picked up the kids in the county?
It's I'm not sure because one of the gentlemen that lived down the street from me, he owned a service station, and he operated the school buses. So I don't know if he actually owned those buses or if they were owned by the school system or exactly who they were owned by. I'm not sure.
May I ask if his name was Richard Roberts?
Yes, Richard.
Okay. I had heard his name mentioned as a gentleman who ran a bus service for kids.
Yes.
Specifically those, like you said, that weren't in town.
Right. He not only he operated the buses, but he also had a small service station there where he would do minor maintenance on vehicles. You could purchase gas there. There was a barber shop and a little confectionery area where you could buy candies and things like that. And that was probably one of the few Black-owned businesses that I can remember in my community anyway.
I was going to ask if you recall any others that were Black-owned, Black-managed at the time.
Well, some of the ones that I remember, we had a community. My area where I live was called Fort Hill. And I'm not sure if that's because there was an army fort there during the Civil War or what, but that was one community, Fort Hill, we called it. Then there was Baptist Town. And there was a gentleman there, his name was Charlie Hunter. And he owned a restaurant, cab stand, I think, and a barbershop was on that corner. And then on Lawrence Street, that's where the primary businesses that I remember were on Lawrence Street. There were a couple of barbershops, maybe one or two restaurants. There was a drugstore on one end, and then on the other end was a funeral home, Hantley's funeral home. And so in between the funeral home and the drugstore, there were a couple of restaurants, which they sold beer and things like that, and a couple of barbershops. And that was about it. As far as other Black-owned businesses, that was about it. that I can remember. We had an area called Louisville, but I don't remember any Black-owned businesses there, per se.
So did your parents mostly patronize those businesses, or did they go to the square? Did they go elsewhere for clothes and groceries?
Yeah, when you say Black-owned businesses, there were no Black-owned grocery stores or Black-owned businesses on the square. The part of the square, well, not the square actually, because the part of Lawrence Street was off of the square. It wasn't actually on the square. So as far as clothing and things like that, we would go to Leader's department store, some other department stores there on the square. As far as grocery shopping, we would go to, there was an A&P on Roswell Street. And there was a, I believe, Big Apple on Roswell Street. And so that was about the extent of our shopping, was either at the grocery stores, those two mainly, a few of the businesses on the square. My mother and father didn't patronize that Lawrence Street area that much. Most of their shopping was on the square.
Can you talk about them not patronizing stores on Lawrence Street? What was the reason for that?
I'm not sure. I'm really not sure. I think my father, maybe he used the barbershops there. But as far as the restaurants, the small restaurants and all, I never remember them going there.
What were your parents' personalities?
My father was a mild-mannered man. He, like I said, he worked in Atlanta, so he commuted to Atlanta and commuted back in the afternoons. And mostly when he got back from work in the afternoons, he would spend some time at home, and then directly across the street from our house lived my aunt, his sister. So he spent a lot of time with his siblings. He had sister and a brother there. And he loved drawing and painting. He gardened a bit. Didn't own a car, didn't own a vehicle. So most of the places that we went to when we went shopping or whatever, we walked. But he was a mild-mannered man and took up a lot of time with me. I attribute most of my success in life to what he taught me growing up, to be honest and fair. And he would attend church from time to time. And but again, he was a cordial, well-mannered and mild-mannered person, I think. And my mother was pretty much the same. She pretty much kept to herself. Because of segregation, there was not many places that you could attend. Church, maybe the shopping, but as far as entertainment and things like that, they didn't go. There was actually few places to go. I mean, if you went to the Strand Theater, that was segregated, and so it wasn't a whole lot to do there other than spend time with family.
So I know with the Strand, there would have been a separate entrance.
It was.
So were your parents rejecting that segregated experience altogether?
I'm not sure. I think they enjoyed spending time with family and friends rather than attending the movies, because I may remember them going to the movie once, and that might have been Gone with the Wind back in the mid-50s, 60s or so. But I think they enjoyed, my mother and my father both had siblings in the area. So a lot of the weekends when they were off from work, they spent their time with family.
Can you describe the home you lived in?
We lived, I'm almost certain, my father served in World War II. So I'm almost certain that he used his GI Bill And we lived in a, to purchase the property that I was raised on. And so we lived in a two-bedroom home, and it was on about an acre of land on Ford Street. It was, when I remember moving in, the house had just been completed, had just been built. So we owned our home and a pretty large portion of land. So that was fun growing up there in our own home and on land there.
Did, were you conscious of differences of class among your family, friends, people like that, or did everybody kind of seem like they were on the same level as your family financially?
You know, growing up, it seems as though everyone was pretty much on the same level, whether they were teachers, principals, folks, pastors, everybody was pretty much on the same level. No one gave any indication that they were better off than you were. It was more or less family. I could talk with my teachers or my pastor just as I would with my mother or father. I never got the feeling that I was any different.
Did you know people? Did you socialize with people who lived at Fort Hill Homes, other public housing projects in the area?
I did. Most of my friends lived in the projects, Fort Hill Homes. My aunt, Louise, lived on Cold Street. And so she owned her home. And so I would spend a lot of time with her when my parents were working. She would kind of take care of me. And so that gave me a chance to build a lot of relationships with folks that lived in the projects. I had cousins and school friends, all that lived in the projects. And so most of my time growing up, I spent a lot of time in the projects, playing, skating at the spray pool, and just enjoyed that time. I mean, that was a special place for me.
And you said your father sometimes attended church. Where did your family go?
Well, our church was Turner Chapel AME Church, and it was located on Lawrence Street also, across the street from the business area there. I believe Turner Chapel during the Civil War was a hospital, if I'm not mistaken. And then I'm not exactly sure when it was converted to a church, but that's where we attended church, Turner Chapel AME Church. And my uncle also pastored that church for a short time.
What was his name?
His name was Amos Harris.
Okay. So you spoke a little bit about the about how your family socialized mostly at home on the weekends. Can you talk to me about any interactions with white people at the time? Did you have interactions with white people? And if so, what were they?
Well, normally, the interactions that I can remember were normally if you, say for an example, on the square where most of the stores were located, if you went in to purchase shoes or shirts or something like that, there would be interaction there or at the various stores that you went into. But other than that, none. I can remember my mother when she did domestic work, and also my aunt, she did domestic work. Oftentimes their employer would drive them home or would pick them up, and that would be a white person, man or female. Some interaction there, but not very little. Since that was doing segregation, we pretty much stayed in our communities, and there was very little interaction.
At the stores on the square, could you go in? I mean, how did that work?
Oh yes, we could you could go into the stores and shop. I didn't feel any adverse treatment there, I guess because we were spending money there. But there's not a big problem going into the store shopping. I can remember many times there was a 5 and 10 cent store, McClellan's, and that was one of my favorite places to go and shop and look around. And then other stores there on the square, but I never felt any adverse treatment when I went into those stores. The grocery stores and things like that were about the same. And so it was during that time, it was segregation, but that was just the way things were. You didn't have anything to compare it to. So I felt at ease and I thought it was a good time to be growing up at that age.
Had you heard of any incidents, or did you experience any incidents of open racism?
I did on several. One of the couple of the ones that really stick out the most. I can remember once my mother had taken me shopping on the square, and she needed to use the restroom. So you could shop in the stores there, but we weren't allowed. There were no restrooms to be used, and the few places that you could use the restroom would have been the shops on Lawrence Street, the black shops. But we were on the west side of the square, so I think that was too far for her to go back. And so that was a train station that had what we call white and colored restrooms. And so my mom said, well, we'll go down to the train station. So we got there, and the train station was closed. And so she couldn't use the restroom. And that really hurt because of the fashion that she had to relieve herself there behind the train station. So, and that stayed with me all my life. The other, I remember once a white salesman had come to our home, and he was, I forget exactly what he was selling, but my father was not buying. And so when he left, this salesman was very upset. And so when he left, he spat on me and he called me a name. I won't say what it was, but that's a couple that have stayed with me throughout my life. But there are other instances, but those are the two that really, I think, hurt the most.
Well, did you travel outside of Marietta? You spoke about, you know, not seeing a different situation necessarily. Did you travel to Atlanta much as a kid or elsewhere?
I did. My father would take me to work with him quite often to Atlanta. And I would spend days with him, around that office setting. And then we'd go to lunch. A lot of times I would travel to Augusta, Georgia. That's where my uncle lived, the pastor that I told you about. His name was Amos Harris. So after he left Turner Chapel, he was appointed to a church there in Augusta. So I would go to Augusta over the summers, several summers I spent there. And I also attended my first year of college at Payne College in Augusta. Other than that, maybe to Rome, Georgia, or some of the other outlying cities, because I played in the band at Lemon Street. So we did travel to different cities in Georgia. And that was pretty much the extent of my travel growing up in Marietta.
Were you conscious of any differences between Marietta and, say, Augusta at the time in terms of, race, but also just general social interactions? Was that something you were conscious of at the time?
It was pretty much the same as it was there in Marietta. I mean, Augusta was segregated, so pretty much what I experienced in Marietta, I experienced there in Augusta. Augusta did, I think, have quite a few more Black-owned businesses than were in Marietta. But other than that, it was anywhere you went in the state during that time, as a Black person, you knew where you could go and where you could not go.
Do you remember your parents ever commenting on these incidents you spoke about, or the situation more generally?
About what situation?
Well, so it's the 50s, right? I mean, are they the type to follow the news closely? Are they the type to talk about it, to say, well, look at this happening, look at that happening?
They did. I can remember the civil rights marches, not so much in Marietta, but in Birmingham and other places. And, you know, they kind of cautioned me, and I'm not sure if other parents did the same, but they kind of cautioned us to be aware of our surroundings and maybe not so much to get involved in that kind of thing, because you could get hurt. But as time went on, I realized that the importance of the civil rights movement, but they would comment on things like that. Maybe the presidential races when Eisenhower was elected, I can kind of remember them commenting on that. The Kennedy election, the Kennedy assassination, those kind of things we talk about. But other events, no, not a lot.
Did they take a paper or have a radio or TV?
We did take the paper, and we did have, we got a TV. I guess I must have been maybe 8 or 9 years old. And they would also Marietta Journal, I think. And we did have TV and radio. And that was about the extent of entertainment, I think.
Well, let's move on to school. Okay. So at what age did you start school?
I started in 1953, and I must have been, 6 years old.
And had you been the type to, you know, read books with your parents prior to starting school? I mean, what was your...
My mother would read different books. I wish I may think of a couple. Not my dad. He didn't spend a lot of time reading that I remember. But my mother would read and I think prepare me for school. And my aunt, as I mentioned, Louise, lived on Cole Street. And she had some of the teachers would rent rooms from her. So I kind of got a little bit of an acclimation to school just listening to them talk about their day and that kind of thing. But as far as any formal preparation for school, I don't remember receiving that.
Was this your Aunt Ursuline?
No, this was my Aunt Louise on my mother's sister.
Tell me her last name.
Pinckney.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So she actually had teachers renting rooms from her.
Right. And she also had a daughter that taught in the elementary school. Her name was Cornelia Pinckney.
So those teachers that lived with her, I mean, I assume, like so many, I know of a boarding house on Lemon Street.
Right.
Where they were mostly out-of-towners.
Out-of-towners. They'd come in maybe from Atlanta or other places, and they would stay with her for the school week, and then they would commute back to Atlanta to wherever they lived.
Okay. Had your parents attended Lemon Street?
No, my mother, her school years would have been in Gainesville, Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
And my father, I don't think Lemon Street was there during his school years. I'm not sure where he attended school. That's a good question.
And were you, so your mother was from Gainesville, your father had grown up in Marietta. Okay.
Exactly. I'm not sure how they met or anything like that.
Do you know how sort of long your father's family had been in the area?
I'm not sure. I didn't get a chance to meet my grandparents. I only knew a couple of my father's siblings, and his sister, my Aunt Fanny, and my Uncle Henry. And then he had several other siblings, my Uncle Homer, Willard, Arthur Mack, and some others that during the Great Migration, they moved north to Washington, New York, a couple of aunts in Michigan, Detroit, that area. So they pretty much left the South and they never returned. But my father and those two siblings stayed there in Marietta. I'm not sure why. I often wonder about that. Why didn't they leave? But I'm glad they didn't, but I often think about it.
Why are you glad they didn't?
Because of the upbringing that they gave me and the fact that that whole community, Marietta, even with the segregation, I really feel that I got the best preparation that prepared me for my journey, my life's journey. Because even though I thought my education was substandard because we had the best teachers, and I always questioned, am I going to be able to make it in the world? But I realized once I started to compete with others that I was just as prepared as they were, even coming from that segregated background. It prepared me for life, and I wouldn't trade that for the world.
How much communication, or do you know how much communication your father had with his siblings who had moved north?
Well, the two brothers that moved to Washington, we would visit them periodically, maybe every summer, every other summer. Because he worked for the railroad, he was given free passes. So he would take my mother and I to Washington almost every summer, every other summer. I can remember those trips. As far as my aunts in New York and Michigan, I think I may have visited them maybe once or twice. So they did keep in contact. And then some of the cousins would even come back south on their vacations to just visit their parents or siblings or something like that. But even with the separation, they kind of kept in contact so everyone knew what was going on with each other.
What was the train service that you took?
It was Southern Railroad in Atlanta on Mitchell Street. That's where the main hub was, I think, on Mitchell Street. Did you ask the name of the train?
Well, the Southern Railroad, that makes sense. How were the cars arranged? Were they by color? How did that work?
I'm having a tough time with that one. I can't remember. I would imagine that they were segregated. If not by car, by seating for sure. Just as the buses were in Marietta, the Greyhound buses. I mean, as many times as I traveled with my father to work between Marietta and Atlanta, we would catch the bus there at the bus station in Marietta, and we always sat in the back, the last seat in the back. And so if the bus wasn't full and we moved up a couple of seats on the way to Atlanta, white folks would move on to the bus, we'd have to get up and give up our seat and move to the back. As far as the train, I'm pretty sure it was segregated to an extent. I'm just not sure if it was by car or by seating in a particular car.
Well, I'll ask just one more question about your family members who had moved north. You mentioned being grateful for your own upbringing and the sort of space that you were growing up in. What differences did you notice between your family life and their family life when you visited in the summers?
In the summers in Washington, D.C. and in Michigan, there was still segregation. I mean, it wasn't maybe as open as it was in Georgia, but I could feel the tension. I can remember shopping. I remember restaurants, they were pretty much segregated because I'm talking about the, you know, the mid 50s and early 60s. So I guess the biggest thing that I remember about it was just having a chance to see a different place. At least in Washington, I got a chance to visit the monuments and kind of do the tourism thing there in Washington. But there was still, you could feel the tension. There was still separation, if you will.
Well, let's return to your school life. You mentioned that you started at age 6.
Right.
And you were starting at Lemon Street Elementary, the brick facility.
Yes.
So describe the school when you first started, the layout, what you remember of the space that you attended each day.
Okay. I believe that building is still there. At least the last time I visited home, it was there. And so if you were looking, I never went through the front doors of the school. I mean, that if you were on Lemon Street facing the front doors, there were a few steps that went up and then you went into the building. I always entered on the left side of the building. And I don't know if that's because of where I was coming from, but anyway, if you went in from that left side, you went into the building, and my first grade room was on the right-hand side as you walked into the building. That teacher's name was Miss Edwards. And then my second grade class was just a few feet down from there, and it was also on the right. And that teacher's name was Miss Edwards. And there was a cafeteria on the left, a restroom, and then you continued down the hallway and intersected with another hallway. So if you went right, the principal's office was on the right. And then if you went left, there were other classrooms down on both sides of the hallway. So all of my, I can remember most of my teachers, Miss Edwards, Miss Jackson, Miss Canty. And then there was an annex that was built right behind the main building. And I attended a few classes there. I think sixth grade, Mr. Maxwell. That's about it because my fifth grade was Miss Canty, and that was in that original building. And then I went to the annex for sixth grade. And that was about it in that building.
Do you remember the class size, number of students?
Number of students. Wow. Let's see. Probably first grade from what I can remember. I don't think more than 20. Maybe not even that many. 10, maybe 15, maybe.
Oh, that's surprising. Okay.
That's what I'm thinking anyway.
I know that later in the 50s, the numbers swelled a bit.
Right.
And they, I had spoken to one teacher, Jenny Gresham, I don't know if you know her name.
I don't.
She passed away this past March, but she was teaching in like a lounge before she got her own classroom.
Oh, okay.
Because of space issues.
Right.
And so that may have become more of an issue in the later.
Did you teach there?
It was 54, starting in 54, 55.
Okay.
I think she taught sixth grade.
Sixth grade. Okay. Maybe I'm just having memory lapse. I don't remember her.
So what subjects do you remember learning while you were at the elementary school?
Well, we did the whole, you know, reading, writing, arithmetic, some history. Mainly, I can remember sixth grade, the history. Fifth grade was, I think, when I started the multiplications, you know. And so the first few years, again, was the reading, the writing, the arithmetic. We had the Dick and Jane reader that we called it, that we started out with, I think, in first grade. I don't know if you're familiar with that Dick and Jane reader.
Certainly, yeah, I heard of it, yeah.
Yep, and of course, spelling and the basics. I really loved Mr. Maxwell's class because that was sixth grade, and the history and the courses that he taught, I think, would really prepare us for high school. And those are the subjects that I love the most, though.
What distinguished him from other teachers?
He was the first male teacher that I had. And so his qualities, I started to really realize what Black men had to offer, you know, if we prepared ourselves. And so it was just his mannerisms, the way he taught his classes, the fact that he was tough, but he was fair. And I really liked him. I really admired Mr. Maxwell.
Do you remember the principal?
The principal in elementary school?
Yes.
I believe our first principal was Mr. Woods, if my memory serves me correctly, starting first, second grade. I'm not sure who the principal was after him. I know my cousin, Aaron Adams, he was a principal there for a while. It's my first cousin. And other than Mr. Woods and Mr. Maxwell, if there were others, they're just not ringing a bell right now.
Tell me how you were related to Aaron Adams.
He's my first cousin.
So did you interact with his family a good bit?
Oh, yes. His mother was my aunt. Her name was Clara Adams. His son, Isaac Adams, we were second cousins. And he lived maybe a block or two from where we lived in that Fort Hill area.
What kind of a guy was he?
Oh, he set the example for me because he was a Christian man. And I watched him a lot. He was a mentor, I guess, for me, even though he was much older than I was. He was a mentor and someone that I looked up to and someone that I often thought about during my journey through life. I could always reflect back on how he carried himself, what he meant to the community. He taught Sunday school. He's a principal. I'm not sure what degree level he had. I'm not sure if it was master's or if he went past that, but he was always a mentor and someone that I looked up to and admired for what he did in the community and the fact that he wasn't just moving through life with no ambition, because he did have ambition. And he had, he just had that will to give back.
Can you tell me a little bit about the relationships between teachers and your parents? Were your parents in the types to be involved, or were they more hands off?
The teachers were easy to talk to. I don't remember a lot of interaction between my parents and teachers, except for the parent-teacher association meetings. Other than that, social gatherings, things like that. I don't remember my family, my parents getting involved with the teachers or the staff at school. I did have one teacher. His name was Preston Williams, and he was related. He was a distant cousin to my mom, to my mother. So I do remember my family, my dad, my mom, interacting with he and his wife. But as far as others, I don't remember that.
How frequent were those PTA meetings?
Maybe monthly or quarterly, I'm not sure.
And where were they held?
Probably at the high school or the elementary school in one of the auditoriums or something like that. I'm not aware. Sorry.
And the materials that you used, you talked about the Dick and Jane reader. Did you have, you know, textbooks each year? And what condition were they in when you got them?
Well, from what I can remember, going back maybe to high school, also elementary, from what I can remember, they were always hand-me-downs. The books, I can remember getting books, pages were torn out. You know, they probably had been used several times before we got them. So when we got the books, they were used. No, I never remember getting a new book, to my recollection. And so we get the books, and then we'd have to put book covers on them and try to maintain the condition, but they were really worse than secondhand.
Do you recall how the teachers dealt with that? Were there complaints from the students? I mean, did teachers say, well, we just got to deal with it? I mean, what was the...
I think we made the best with what we had. I don't remember any complaints. You know, I remember the first day of class, you get your books, two or three books, whatever, and we get book covers, the brown book covers, and we'd have to put the brown book covers on there, but there were never any complaints because our teachers were, they were prepared, I think, to probably do as well with or without the book. Because of their knowledge and experience, they could fill the gap, the missing pages or things like that. So it wasn't a situation where we did a lot of complaining. We just we took what we had and we learned and we moved on.
Were folks on the administrative level for the school system ever around, like a superintendent, somebody like that?
I don't remember. If they were, it wasn't that I can remember any one of them. I remember a school nurse. I don't remember a school superintendent. Maybe they did come, but they were probably in the principal's office. I don't remember them spending any time with the students per se. I may be wrong on that, but I just don't remember them visiting that much.
Well, the nurse, was that a white person or a black person?
She was white. And this was probably during my elementary years. And I can't remember her name, but I do remember a school nurse coming from time to time. And I never remember interacting with her. I just remember her being there. And to this day, I don't know why, but she was there.
So what year did you cross the street? What grade level, I should ask?
Seventh grade, I went to the high school.
Well, I mean, what did you anticipate? What were you expecting? Or were you so familiar with it already because of all the back and forth?
Probably a little familiar because in, I think, fifth or sixth grade, I started working with the band. So we would have band rehearsals. A lot of times those were held in the high school building. So I'd get a chance to see some of the high school students, see some of the high school teachers and that kind of thing. So when I actually went to seventh grade, I knew most of the teachers. I knew where most of the classrooms were. So it was just a matter of transitioning from one side of the street to the other, because most of the people we interacted with either during the school week or on a school weekend. And so we knew the folks, you know, so it wasn't a tough transition going from sixth grade to seventh grade.
Were high school students ever coming over to the elementary school for any reason when you were in the elementary school?
The only thing I think I can remember that they would have come to that building for would have been to the lunchroom. There was one lunchroom that was in the elementary building. And so the high school students, if they ate lunch at all, I think they would have to come there.
That's my understanding, right? Because there wasn't one in the high school building.
High school, no. Not that I remember, no.
Was the gym behind the high school by the time you got there?
You have to repeat that. You broke up.
Oh, I'm sorry. Was the gym behind the high school when you got there?
It was. Yes, it was. It was behind the high school. And you went in the front doors there at the high school. You could either go right or left, down the hall, down some steps into the gym. And so it was there. Yeah, the whole time I was there, the gym was right there behind the high school.
Tell me about some of your teachers at the high school, teachers, administrators, others in positions of authority.
Yes, and all of them, all of my teachers in both the elementary and the high school were exceptional. And what I mean by that is, and I said this a little earlier, I wasn't really sure when I graduated from high school if I was going to be able to compete in the world. And much to my surprise, as I said, I was just as prepared as the white guys that I met in the military. I mean, through the training, through all of the exercises that we went through, I was just as prepared. And I think some of the folks that helped do that to prepare me for my journey, Mr. Ruff, who was the principal, he was stern, but he was fair. I got a couple of spankings from him for doing things. Mr. Scott was instrumental, Ms. Fred, Mr. Williams, Mr. Jackson, Ms. Wilkins, Ms. Williams, so many, I could just go on and on. Mr. Sadler, even though we gave them a hard time, I think, from time to time, they did a very good job, exceptional job, as I said, in preparing me for the world. And so when I look back at my point in life now, when I look back, I would not have traded it for the world.
Well, you know, one of the things that I have noticed looking through yearbooks is they would list teachers' degrees.
Right. And
so many of them had, you know, master's degrees.
Right.
And I know Principal Ruff was intentional about that. At least that's what he told me, that he was intentional about making teachers go and get the degrees, driving them down, him and Lewis Scott. Which is, I mean, it's so clearly they were very educated for the time.
When did you talk with him?
I talked with Mr. Ruff in February of last year, and he passed away about 6 weeks later.
Oh, okay.
So his interview is in the collection.
It is. I'll have to listen to that.
Yeah, that was a really special one. He was quite a guy. And his daughter is Sandra, who should be about your age.
Maybe a year or two younger. I remember her being one or two grades behind me.
Right.
But yes, just about right there together, though.
So tell me, you, of course, mentioned the band. Talk to me about how often the band met for practice and for performance.
Well, we normally would, the band was a marching band and a concert band. So we did both marching and concert. And primarily the marching band, we performed at football games during the regular football season. And so we would meet, we would practice. What I remember, the primary instructors I remember were Mr. Stubbs, a couple of others, but Mr. Stubbs probably stands out the most for me, is because he came to Lemon Street and he completely transformed our music department. Not to say that we weren't good in the beginning, but he kind of transformed our whole program. And so we would practice during the football season. It was like every day, from what I remember, and weekends. And it wasn't, you know, 1 or 2 hours, because not only did we have to know the music or be able to read the music, but we had to be able to perform the marching in the different movements. So he would really, he was intense about our sessions when we would practice. Like I say, we'd practice almost every day, sometimes into the wee hours of the evening, and then sometimes on the weekend when we were preparing for competition. So that was maybe September through the end of the football season, which would probably be, I guess, December, January, maybe. And then we made the transition from a marching band to a concert performing band. And that required a lot of practice and rehearsing. So it was a memorable experience. And again, I think that portion of my education at Lemon Street also just prepared me for what was in store when I moved on.
What did you play?
I started playing the trumpet, and I played trumpet for, I want to say, 2-3 years. And then when Mr. Stubbs came, we had the bass horn, a tuba. They were brass. But when he came, we got fiberglass. I don't know if you know, you understand the terminology of fiberglass versus the...
Sure. I'm sure I've seen a fiberglass tuba perform.
Yeah. I mean, they're different than the brass.
Right.
So, you know, he bought all new fiberglass tubas, and I was one of the first ones to get one of those.
Is the mouthpiece fiberglass?
No, it's brass, but the whole instrument is white. It's white fiberglass.
Mm-hmm.
And that was just a thrill of my life to be selected to play one of those.
What's the difference in the sound between the two?
I think the sound is pretty much the same. It's just the weight. You know, those brass tubas or bass horns, they're pretty heavy. And so, but the fiberglass is much lighter, and it doesn't require as much. It's not as strenuous as the others.
For the marching band pieces, were you playing popular music or standards from the past?
Mostly it was popular. Because of what Mr. Stubbs, he attended Florida A&M University, and they had a tremendous marching band and concert band. And so he tried to keep us on the cutting edge with the most recent and most, I would say, popular songs that appealed to the audience. So it wasn't standards or things like that. It was more current pop, maybe jazz type of arrangements.
And did you perform anywhere in marching band other than halftime shows, like competitions, parades, things like that?
Parades, we did parades there at Marietta. I remember, I'm not sure exactly, but we would, whenever we had homecoming, we would perform downtown Marietta. And then there were other occasions where we would perform in downtown Marietta around the square. Sometimes we go out of town for different events and perform there also.
And how big, how many members in the band when you were there?
I want to say maybe 50. I don't know if that's exaggerating, but somewhere around 50 or so, I would think.
Okay. Other than band, what kind of a student were you in terms of your studies, your grades, things like that?
I was average. I wasn't a bookworm, no. I enjoyed my childhood and the time in high school. I wasn't a studious person, but I graduated with maybe a 3.0. I was able to go to college, but I didn't probably prepare myself as well as others that were there during that time. I don't regret that. I know I probably could have done better, but our teachers, like I said, I don't think I missed out on anything. I don't think I missed by not being as studious as I could have been. It didn't really hurt me in the long run.
What were your parents and teachers' expectations for you?
My parents, all of my relatives, my parents, my several cousins were teachers. Like I mentioned, Aaron Adams, he was a principal. I mentioned Kenita Adams, that was my first cousin. She was a teacher. My Uncle Amos, I told you, who was a pastor there in Marietta, his daughters were teachers. So I was expected to number one, get an education. That was just, you know, it was no doubt about that. The expectation was there. I was encouraged. Whenever I talked with my cousins, my aunts, they were all educated. They'd all graduated from college. And so it was just expected that I would also, continue my education after high school. And I did.
And I know you mentioned the connection to Augusta. Was Payne always the one that you were considering, or did you consider others?
I considered others. Morris Brown was one consideration, but I chose Payne because of my family ties there in Augusta, my uncle, my aunt, my cousins. And so I knew that I think Augusta's maybe 100, over 100 miles or so from Marietta. I knew that I wanted to actually, after high school, I wanted to see some other places. And so I thought Augusta would be a good place to start. I'd have roots there that I could always go. I did live on campus, but I could always go to my relatives' homes if things weren't going exactly like I wanted. So I went to Payne for a year and a half. And then I was drafted into the military during the Vietnam War.
Well, may I ask, what was the payment plan for Payne?
Well, when you say payment plan,
I'm curious. I don't want to just say how'd you pay for it, but like, was it a scholarship? Did your parents pay? How did that work?
Yes, paid. It wasn't a scholarship. I didn't receive a scholarship. No. And from what I remember, the first payment that I can remember my aunt making there the day I registered was something like $300-$400. It wasn't a lot of money.
Wow. And you said you lived in a dorm?
I lived in the dorm, but I also helped financially. I worked in the cafeteria and did some other odd jobs there on campus to help with my tuition and books and things like that.
And what were you studying to begin with?
From what I remember, I think I was going to major in chemistry. Why chemistry? I don't have the slightest idea, because I wasn't that great in math. I wasn't that great in chemistry in high school, but we had, there were these twin brothers, and I'm trying to remember their names now, but one went to Payne College, and that was his major, was chemistry. And I said, well, if he can do chemistry, I guess I can too. And I'm trying to remember their name, Alfred and Stafford, their last names. I don't remember.
They were from Marietta?
Marietta, yes.
Were there other former classmates who went to Payne?
There was one other young lady. Her name was Joy Wright. I think she went to Payne.
So you said you were there only for a year and a half.
Yeah, I went in September of 1965, and I was drafted in December of 66.
Well, before we go on, are you comfortable with another 20 minutes or so?
Yeah, I'm fine.
Okay.
Whatever it takes, I'm...
Well, I like to knock it out, you know, at once, but I don't want to tire you, and we can always do more later.
The information you need. I hope it's not repetitive.
Oh no, this is wonderful. I'm excited that you reached out, because all the beginning ones we sought out, and this is how we wanted this to go. So I really appreciate you reaching out to us after seeing the collection. So tell me about receiving your draft notice, and before that, I'd like to know, you know, did you anticipate that it was coming? Were you following what was going on with the war?
I was following what was going on with the war. I did not anticipate the draft because I was a college student. And during that time, if you were a college student, you were normally given a deferment. But during that time frame, somewhere along 66, latter part of 66, there was a deferment test that was initiated by the government. So if you were a college student, in order to remain in college, you had to take this deferment test and pass it to be able to remain in college. I don't know if you heard about that or not.
I don't know about this one.
Yeah, the deferment test. So I was called in, and I was told that I needed to, if I wanted to remain at Payne, I needed to go to Atlanta, I think one of the colleges there, and take this deferment test. It was a group of us. And so, long story short, I failed the deferment test. There was no way that I could, if my memory serves me correctly, the way that test was set up, there was just no way that I was going to be able to pass it. That, you know, the math, some of the other questions that they were asked were just beyond what I could handle. And so I was drafted in 1966.
So you would have preferred not to be drafted, is what you're saying?
I would have, because I was keeping up with the news and what was going on in Vietnam and the numbers of casualties and deaths that were happening there. I had classmates that had been had gone to Vietnam and been killed. And so I just was not ready for that. But with the draft, there was no other option. when I got the draft notice, that pretty much ended my college days.
Do you remember sharing that news with your parents and their reaction?
I do. I remember sharing it, but I can't remember their reactions. Maybe my mother was a little reluctant and didn't really want me to go. But my dad had served during World War II, and my brother served in Korea. So they pretty much felt that, that I'd be okay.
So tell me where you reported for basic training.
Yeah, well, I would, just to give you a little story, how I ended up in the Air Force, during that time, during the draft, if you got the draft notice, that meant that you had to serve, and it didn't necessarily mean that you had to go Army, Air Force, or what service. It just meant that you had to serve. And so my desire was to join the Air Force. And I had talked with the Air Force recruiter, and during that time, I don't know if it was discrimination or not, but I went in and talked with the Air Force recruiter, and he told me that they did not have any openings for new recruits during that month. And so I left the Air Force recruiter's office, and I was going to join the Marines. And my brother, who I mentioned a little earlier, he was one of the first, if not the first, African-American postman in Marietta. And so I met my brother on the way to the Marine recruiter's office, and he wanted to know why was I going to the Marine recruiter's office. And I told him, well, the Air Force turned me down. No more quotas. So the Air Force recruiter's office was on his route. He carried mail there to the Air Force recruiter's office. And so he said, well, let's go back down to the Air Force recruiter's office. I'll see what I can do. And we got back. He talked with the recruiter because he knew the recruiter. He saw him every day when he brought mail, and he told him that I was his brother. And instantly, this recruiter accepted me. He gave me the test. Matter of fact, he even helped me with the test. And that next day, I was on a plane on my way to Lackland Air Force Base in Texas to join Air Force. But it was it was a blessing the way that happened, because had I not seen my brother, and had my brother not known this Air Force recruiter, I never would have gotten into the Air Force. It was just they from what I understand, I don't know why they turned folks down, but some folks got in, some didn't. But I was fortunate enough to make it in, and that was a blessing.
And was basic training, tell me about basic training.
Well, basic training was, from what I remember, 12 weeks. I went to Lackland Air Force Base in January of 1967. I went through the 12 weeks of basic training there. It was not a tough basic training, not compared with some of the other services. We did the physical exercise, the classroom, the artillery kind of things. And then I was there for 12 weeks, and then I went to Shepherd Air Force Base for my specialized training, which was aircraft maintenance. And I was there until, I think, July of 1967.
And you said you wanted to go in the Air Force. So aircraft maintenance, how did you get into that?
Well, we were given aptitude tests during the basic training portion, and my aptitude was more fitted for, aircraft maintenance as opposed to some of the other specialties. And so that was a career field that fit me perfectly, because once I was able to complete the initial training and get my first assignment, I pretty much excelled in aircraft maintenance, because I attended several schools during that time. And as I told you, I was able to, I stayed in aircraft maintenance my entire career, which was 24 years. But I advanced from the enlisted ranks into the officer ranks. And all of that was started with that one basic training school that prepared me for aircraft maintenance work. And I loved it.
So talk to me about your tours overseas.
Tours overseas, some of them, I'll just kind of give you a list of some of the places that I went. I served in Vietnam in 1968. In Southeast Asia, Vietnam, Thailand. I also served in, did a short time in Korea. Some of my other assignments, quite a few stateside assignments, Arizona, Virginia, Illinois, England, some others, Japan, Tokyo, Japan, and just several assignments worldwide. So I did quite a bit of travel and loved every minute of it. Excuse me. We can see up here.
With aircraft maintenance, you know, what were your general responsibilities? Did it stay consistent throughout these different assignments, or were you making your way up? How did that work?
Believe it or not, I started as a E1 aircraft, entry-level aircraft maintenance. So I was an enlisted person. But my last assignment, when I retired in 1990, I was chief of maintenance for the 48th Fighter Interceptor Squadron at Langley. So I was pretty much responsible for an entire squadron of F-15 aircraft. Part of that, between those two points, between the enlisted time and the time I retired, I held several positions in aircraft maintenance, OIC of aircraft maintenance squadrons, chief of maintenance, and all of that started from just a basic knowledge of that career field. So I was able to not only get my bachelor's degree, but two master's degrees while on active duty. And again, I attribute all of that to what I learned at Lemon Street High School. Because I was able, as I said, I was able to, wasn't real sure if I was prepared for life with the education that I had received, but I was more than prepared. I excelled in almost every area during my military career. I made all of my promotions on time. The assignments that I was selected for were choice assignments. People would have, some of the assignments that I got, people would have died to get them because they were just that choice type of assignments. And so I retired in 1990. As I said, I spent 13 years as an enlisted member. I attained the rank of E6. And then after I completed my bachelor's degree, I was selected for officer training. And I went back to Lackland Air Force Base in Texas to officer training school. And then I spent the next 10 years as a commissioned officer, and I retired as a captain. Needless to say, I retired because my family wanted me to be at home a little more than I was traveling quite a bit. My goal was to stay 35 years, but I cut it short because of the family and some of the things they wanted to do.
You were in your early 40s then.
I retired, yes.
And tell me where you met your wife and what her name is.
My wife's name is Sandra Adams. I met her during my first assignment in Tucson, Arizona. So we met in 68, and I think we married in 69. So we just completed 51 years of marriage this past December.
Is she from Tucson?
From Tucson, yes.
Any differences you noticed in growing up experiences between the South and the West?
Yes. I didn't experience near the, so I went to Tucson in 1967 when I finished basic training. And so didn't experience a lot of harassment or discrimination in the military during that training time. It was there, but it just wasn't as prevalent as it was growing up in the South. And so when I went to Arizona, it was like night and day between Georgia, the South, and the West. Now, I'm sure there was some problems, but I just didn't see it as readily as I did in the South. I mean, there was no segregation, if you will. I mean, when I went home on leave in the 60s, 67 or so, most of the restaurants were still segregated from what I remember. But in the West, in Arizona, I pretty much, you didn't notice that. And so it was an eye opener. It was a change of environment for me. And it took some getting used to. It took some getting used to being able to sit where you want to sit, go to the same bathroom as the next guy. And it was just almost a different world, if you will.
Did your wife ever comment on it from the opposite perspective of coming to visit the South? Yeah.
She did. That was eye-opener for her, because her whole experience, educational experience, I say from first grade through high school, was discrimination. There was no segregation. So she went to school. It was Black, White, Hispanic, Native American. I mean, it was just a conglomeration of, everyone. They were just, that's just the way it was. So she couldn't believe when I brought her to Georgia for the first time, she couldn't believe what she was experiencing there. And so, yes, it was the same for her coming South as it was for me going West. It was just like two different worlds.
So after you retired, you said, were discharged from the military, that was 1990.
I retired in 1990, yes.
Tell me a little about your post-military career up through your retirement in Virginia.
Yeah, well, again, I have to just comment on my early childhood preparation. And the fact that it did prepare me for life, some of the things that I learned in school. So as I say, my parents and my relatives all, there was no doubt that education was the key. That if you were going to excel, if you're going to do better in life, then you needed to be prepared. And so you can't you can't achieve some of the things that you want to achieve without being prepared. So I kind of had that in the back of my mind at the beginning. I knew that education was key. I knew that if I wanted to do things that I wanted to do, that I was going to need to have more than a high school education. And so getting the bachelor's degree, and I got I received a master's degree in human resources and also a master's in public administration while I was on active duty. So when I retired, I was prepared to enter the civilian workforce. And so again, I pretty much excelled at what I wanted to do. And so one of the first jobs that I had after I retired, I was a human resources manager for the Virginia Employment Commission, a state agency. And I worked there for a couple of years, and then I transferred to Tidewater Community College, which is one of the 29 community colleges here in Virginia. And I went there also as a human resources manager and adjunct faculty. So I worked human resources during the first 8 hours of the day. And then I taught classes at night in business and human resources management. And I worked at Tidewater for, I think, 8-9 years. And then I was selected for a position with the city of Hampton in Hampton, Virginia, as human resource manager and EEO officer. And I worked there for another 5 years or so, and I retired in 2012. And so my life after Lemon Street in Marietta has been nothing but, there's nothing I would change. There's nothing I would change because it has made a difference in my life. And when I look back, even with the segregation and all there, I didn't let that influence me in how I interacted with the white men and women that I met through life, because there's good and bad in everyone. And I've had just as many white men, white women to help me along the way as I did my Black instructors there at Lemon Street. So it all panned out in the end. It all came full circle, and I can look back and say that Marietta was a good place. I enjoyed it. And if I had to do it again, I'd do it all over again. If it came out as well as it did, I'd do it again.
Sounds like you're trying to wrap up right now, Art.
I'm enjoying this. I like bragging on my school and my I can, you know, that's home, and it, you know.
Well, you anticipated one of my final questions, sort of thinking back on the legacy of Lemon Street. But I do want to ask you about flying, because you had mentioned this. Tell me about flying and after your retirement.
Well, you know, during my career in the Air Force, as I said, I was an aircraft maintenance officer. So I was I worked around aircraft my whole career. I got a chance to fly in lots of fighter aircraft and pilots. I interacted with pilots every day to make sure that they were satisfied with the aircraft we were giving them to fly. And so it was always a desire of mine to be able to fly. And because earlier in my life growing up, I was always told, you know, Black men don't fly, Black men can't fly, this, that, and the other. But I saw Black pilots and I said, I can do that. And so to make a long story short, during my military career and shortly after retirement, I didn't have the resources to attend flight training. But once I got them through college, that freed up some extra money that I had, some disposable cash that I could kind of invest in something that I wanted to do. So at age 60, I started taking flying lessons out at the base at Langley. And after a year or so, I was able to complete that, and I got my private pilot license. And so I'm qualified to fly 172, Cessna 172. So that was a lifelong dream that I saw it come to fruition before I got too old.
And you're not currently flying?
Not right now, I'm not, because of the COVID and some other things, but I was able to accomplish that. And it just goes to show you that it doesn't matter where you come from or what you experience in life, the ups, the downs, whatever, you know, if you are passionate about something and you have the will and desire to do it, no matter where you come from, you can do just about anything you want to do.
Absolutely. So to finish up, let me ask you, how often do you visit Marietta today?
Last time I was there, my brother passed in 2011. So I was there 2011. I think I may have come back the year after 2012. But I haven't been back since about 2012.
Well,
I still have friends there. My best friend that I grew up with, John Robinson, he still lives there. I have cousins that are there, but I just haven't had the chance to come and visit like I'd like to. And when I do come, I normally will stay out at Dobbins Air Force Base. I'll get quarters there and stay there for a week or so.
Do you recall, visiting, obviously the high school was torn down within maybe 2 years of you graduating.
Right.
Do you recall your feeling when you came back in the area and saw that it was gone?
Yes, it was hurtful, because that was one of the things I was coming back to see. Whenever I'd come back to visit while I was in the military, whatever, during those times, I always made a special point to go by the school, the high school, the elementary school, even get out and just stand there for a while and chat with friends or whatever. So when I came back and the school was torn down, it was hurtful, yes. Not to see it, because I was expecting it to be there, but the elementary school was still there. So that was kind of consoling in a way.
Well, is there any additional information or thoughts, reflections you'd like to share before we conclude?
Well, I don't think so. I think you did a very good job asking the questions, and I'm just so excited that you're doing what you're doing, because I've looked, my wife can tell you, I'm always online trying to find something about Marietta, about Lemon Street, about the school I went to, about the folks, the teachers, and I just happened to come across your website a month or so ago, and it was a relief to see some of the folks that you've interviewed, some of the pictures. It just brought back so many memories. I'm 73 now, so I have a lot of time to think, you know, and reminisce, and so I can pick up my laptop or go online now if I start feeling homesick, and I can go back and go to your website and click on somebody, Mr. Ruff, or somebody else that I knew, and just listen to them or hear their story. And just to hear their story, they mention things, or they'll mention names of people that I'd forgotten about. And they'll mention that name, and I say, oh, yeah, I remember him. He did this or he did that. And so what you're doing is it's fabulous. I can't commend you enough for the work that you're doing with this.
I appreciate that. Well, let's conclude the interview there. Let me stop recording.